The Guardian. Football Weekly.
It's Football Weekly Extra, FWE, wiping the brow of a sport in fever. Today, Man City, Bellamy's out, Milner's in. Will they be any better, though, as they prepare to meet Liverpool? Man United, they play Fulham this weekend, but did you see Sky's new Monday Night Football? Like a Dixon's AGM reenacted in a cruise ship disco. The future for showcasing the beautiful game. Elsewhere, big kitty for Rovers. Unknown man wants to pay $300 million for Blackburn? Of course he does. Europe, defeat for Spurs amid widespread criticism of the way they play with young boys. Typically, Vatican remains silent. There's Sid in Madrid, with more unveiling than the gates of a French school. And French football itself. Big clubs can't win while the Federation puts a smile back on Nicolas Anelka's face. All of that, plus Kevin Brint's Boateng to Milan via Genoa, explained by Paolo Bandini. Your post and a full preview of the rest of the weekend's games on Football Weekly Extra. Hello, world. Today on the Football Weekly Pod, we have Sean Ingle.
Hello, James.
Paolo Bandini, season debut.
Hello.
And in special, just to be with us, Rob Smythe.
I got out of bed especially, James.
That's so sweet of you, Rob. Otherwise, you could have come in your bed. That would have been impractical.
That would have been interesting.
But very nice, and you even got out of your pyjamas, I think. Tell you what, it's great to have you on board, because we want to talk about Manchester United.
I think people always enjoy that.
Yeah, good. All right. We also want to talk about their neighbours, Man City.
Sure.
Who are continuing to chut lolly around. £126 million now, their summer spending. That's the second highest summer spree ever, of course. And the latest element of it is the arrival of James Milner in exchange for, £26 million, is it?
Well, it's £26 million is where it's been valued. I think it's £16 million plus Stephen Ireland. It's in that ballpark.
So is he only worth £10 million, Stephen Ireland?
He's certainly not been valued especially highly.
I'm surprised about that. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You speak to people at Man City and they say technically he's one of the best players at the club, but mentally that's where Stephen Ireland's problem is.
Mentally?
Well, it's just making that step up and fitting in and belonging. And we've seen that in his career in the past.
But two seasons ago, he did make that step up. He was one of the best players in the country. I think it's really sad the way his career has drifted away. And I hope that this move reinvigorates him. I think he's a fantastic footballer. I thought when Hughes took over and when City got the money, I thought that if they were to follow the Chelsea template, then Ireland would be their Lampard, the constant figure as other players came in around him. And I guess Mancini just didn't fancy him.
Yeah.
But I was surprised a bigger club didn't go in from. I know Villa are obviously a top eight club, but I think he's good enough to play top four if everything's in its right place mentally, as Sean says.
John Barnes Jr. posting in, saying, am I the only one who thinks Stephen Ireland is just as good, if not better, than James Milner? Admittedly, Milner have had a lot of potential. It is an interesting move, though, to Aston Villa. Is that the player they need?
I think they need a lot of players.
Right.
But he is an excellent player. They don't get that many goals from central midfield. He has the capacity to do that. They've always been quite a functional side in central midfield, whereas he's a really good all-purpose player. He's got a lot of ability. So, yeah, I think he'll improve them significantly.
Meantime, Craig Bellamy, no longer of that parish. Your reactions to his decision to drop down to the Championship with Cardiff City?
Yeah, it was an interesting one, wasn't it? He obviously wanted to sell it as, oh, I'm back at the club I've always supported, which, you know, he probably did support them growing up.
You suggest that that's not the way that it...
Well, the only reason I say that, James, is because in 2006, when he signed for Liverpool, he talked about how great it was to sign for the club that he'd supported. So I think there's possibly a little bit of... football speak going on
but
there.
His family's living down that way, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a genuine reason for him to be there. I think his family is in Wales, and I think there's probably an element to him which has thought, I'm 31 and this place to be. But I also think that Manchester City had no interest in selling him to someone who was going to cause them some trouble later on.
I wonder, I mean, this isn't a very English thing to say, but certainly goes on in Spain. Can you have more than one club? Because in Spain, everyone has either Real Madrid and Barcelona and their local club. And I wonder whether perhaps in Wales... you may have your local Welsh club and then also support Liverpool, Man United.
I mean, even if he doesn't support Cardiff, there's still his local... if that's where his family lives, he wants to be with his family, that's fair enough. And he could... sorry, Rob.
Well, I was just going to say two things. When was the last time a player that good played in the First Division? I can't remember. And also, for all his... I'm sure he does love Cardiff. I think he's got a lot of love to give. But if Tottenham had been allowed to sign him, I think there's no question he would have gone there.
He's absolutely a player who's good enough to be playing in the Champions League. Absolutely.
He was superb last season. Yeah, he was outstanding and clearly it's a personality thing
yeah.
with Mancini, which was inevitable. But it's a shame because he was playing some brilliant football. I wonder what happened with Fulham, you know. When it all happened, the obvious thought was, well, he'll go back with Mark Hughes, under whom he always plays his best football. Maybe they just couldn't afford him, I don't know.
Possibly. Or maybe Man City just didn't want to have him anywhere near them.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see what Shay Given does. Sources close to Shay believe that it's going to be either Fulham or bust, or you know, number two choice to Man City. I don't think Arsenal are in for him.
Is that because Manchester City are not allowing Arsenal to be in for Shay Given? Is that the understanding?
I think so, yes.
What's it mean for the Championship, Craig Bellamy, down there? Is it really unfair on all the other...
Well, which club is it in Scotland? I watched.
Oh,
some,
yeah, but then
some
Motherwell.
Having an almighty
Motherwell, but then
hot funk on Sky Sports News the other
yeah.
day, which is slightly unfair. I can understand his point.
Well,
of
yeah,
view.
Except that they themselves went into liquidation, not paying
really?
Off loads of it. That's the thing. You know, there are ethics involved that which make some elements of the Bellamy deal look a bit funny, given that Cardiff are in dire financial straits and haven't paid off other debts, but all of a sudden they're able to field this incredibly top-level player because Man City have done them a favour. So they're going to do a favour to the rest of the Championship.
If
football is such a mess of
if you want ethics, go and see a lawyer or, you know, a philosopher.
If you want ethics,
go and
you know,
sit in our office.
Go to Billericay with someone here with a lisp. That's what I say.
Is that fresh?
Fresh out the box. Yes, indeed. Anyway, now, Man City are taking on FC Timisoara, or words to that effect, in the Europa League qualifiers this very evening. Of course, rather more excitingly than that, perhaps you might feel Liverpool. Big, big Premier League clash. That's on Monday night. That is a big game, though, isn't it?
I'm really looking forward to it. I would say, though, that of the last four games at Eastlands, between the two clubs, three have been 0-0.
Oh,
but that doesn't mean anything. Obviously, this is a newer City side. But you know, I think it's a really fascinating game because if City do want to be in the top four this season, it's the sort of game they certainly shouldn't lose, and they'd hope to win.
Well, what Mancini did last year, and I know City were at a different stage of their development, it was he played for a draw basically home to Liverpool. He plays, and this is his problem. He wants to win the Premier League using, I don't want to say Italian tactics because that's a bit cliche, but say maybe 80s Italian tactics. You know, generally win at home, draw away, but maybe draw the games at home to the big teams. That's not going to win the Premier League. They have to show some intent.
Well, whether they're Italian tactics or not, there's certainly tactics that would be familiar to people who watched him in his time at Inter. I mean, the whole thing at Inter in the league was they were so reliant on Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He would basically set his team up like this all the time and just go, okay, we're going to keep this game tight, we're going to be physical, we're going to be strong, we're going to make sure we don't lose the game, and then, fingers crossed, Zlatan will do something and pull it out for us. And, you know, 8 times out of 10, 9 times out of 10 in Serie A, that worked. I don't think he's got necessarily the sort of forwards at Manchester City. I think he's got great forwards at Manchester City, but the sort of players who actually what you want to be doing with them is getting them running at defenders, getting the sort of momentum going forwards. And I don't know if you've got players who are just going to sort of on their own independently do something brilliant out of nothing.
The other problem you have is that in Italy and Spain, Benitez had this problem. You can win the league with about 75 to 80 points. So I think they come over thinking, well, that will do. Whereas in England, you probably need near 85 to 90. Now, Benitez took 4.5 years to realise this, or 3.5. Whereas Mourinho came over in 04, used to winning league with 90 points for Porto, and took the risks necessary. You know, but Mourinho would win 9 and draw and lose 1 of 10, whereas Mancini might win 6 and draw 4, or win 5 and draw 5. That's not going to win your league. So I think it'll be really interesting to see the first home game against a proper opponent, whether they have the courage to actually really push them or whether they just try and win it 1-0. I think they'll try and win it 1-0.
I think what bothers me as well, if you're going to be that team that's going to sit there and try and keep things tight and not concede goals, is I think the weakest part of their team is their back four.
That's true.
I look at it and I still think you've still got Micah Richards in there, you've still got Kolo Touré in there. These aren't players who I'm especially, you know, overawed by if I'm coming in now with a team like, you know.
Although, of course, he gives them three men protecting them in a lot of games, which is extraordinary, which he did at Tottenham. Right. And like you said, it didn't work. Tottenham should have won.
Tottenham should have scored
by 3 or 4.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how much Liverpool can contest that. We don't know Fernando Torres, if he will be starting this time around, although you'd think that he must be now approaching match fitness. David Ngog?
I don't mind Ngog. He gets a lot of stick. I think he's all right. I mean, he's still raw, but I don't think he was often seen as a real joke figure last season, and I don't see that at all. I think he's a perfectly adequate stand-in for a player as good as Torres. You can't have a backup at that level.
Praise indeed. Man United, Rob, they're at Fulham. Hmm?
Yeah, where they've lost the last two seasons. So, yeah, it'll be an interesting game, that, I think.
What do you think of United this year?
I thought they started very nicely in a game that you wouldn't want to draw many conclusions from because Newcastle was so compliant. But I'd probably make them second favourites to Chelsea. They would have to get lucky with injuries, particularly in central midfield. That's the weakest area. Scholes is having a lovely spell, but he can't play all the games. And also, he won't get teams who stand off him as much as Newcastle and Chelsea did. But they look okay, I think.
Capra Shu says, on Man United blowing $7.5 million on Bebe, is anyone else not thinking something smells very fishy?
I wouldn't like to speculate on that, James.
No, but it's bizarre. So it's one of the most extraordinary... Seen him play.
Yeah, I can't personally remember a more unlikely deal. A player who was available on a free 5 weeks ago, who scored 4 in 26 for a third division Portuguese side, and who Ferguson hasn't seen play. When you think that for the cost of Chris Smalling and Bebe, you could have got Mesut Ozil and had enough left over for a huge bender. It does seem slightly strange to me. But, I mean, look, Ferguson... The one thing I would say, and I wouldn't compare Bebe to Ronaldo, of course, but when Cristiano Ronaldo came, it was for $12.24 million, and everyone said, what the hell is he paying that money for an 18-year-old who's not very well known? In 10 years' time, we might,
but,
you know?
I mean, the whole thing with Ronaldo was, like many Ferguson signings, he'd seen him play well against Manchester United. Had he seen Bebe play against Manchester United?
He hadn't seen him play against anyone. I mean, originally I thought they'd signed him on pre-season friendlies, which would have been bizarre. It's staggering. 4 in 26 for a third division side. Went on a free. His YouTube clip, the first thing on it is him shanking an overhead kick miles wide. It's bizarre.
I mean, he may turn out to be a great player, and, you know, you don't want to prejudge these things. You know, I'm sure someone has scouted him, but it just sort of feels like this is almost like the what could become the hallmark of this transfer window, where no one can buy anyone because there's absolutely nothing happening in the transfer market. That now teams are just going to the homeless World Cup and signing up players for 7 minutes.
Did you watch Monday night's game? MNF. Exciting Sky, the return of Monday Night Football to Sky. Did you see it?
I did. Yeah.
Right. What did you think?
I thought it was all a bit cold and corporate and a bit kind of American. Is that right?
Really? Yeah. Well, I think there's contrast. I mean, obviously, Monday Night Football is an American institution.
Sky Sports coverage, cold and corporate.
Mm. I'm wondering if there's an undercurrent of a raw emotion underneath that supposedly cold. I'm watching. The hosts at work, I just was reminded of Brokeback Mountain, where there was ongoing love that could not speak its name, so they just communicated through the mechanics of being cowboys. And here you just had this, Andy and Richard just expressing, you know, through technology, what they couldn't bear to face.
They've always been like this. I mean, they were on Sky, you know, I remember in the early 90s when they, I mean, you know, Richard came from GMTV,
yep.
Andy had been linked with the Aston Villa job, and they connected over, Sky used to show sort of FA Cup replays, I think, really early on, and League Cup games no one else wanted to show, and they got together then, and they've been together for 20 odd years now.
People are going to say that, you know, we're being started, but I actually think I'm genuinely saying I think it's really nice to watch two
guys. Could you have that team work with Andy Gray? Could you do that?
I actually like Andy Gray.
Did you have that relationship with Ian Dowie on Satanta?
I think Ian Dowie is very I was working with Ian Dowie just yesterday, and he was explaining zonal marking to me with his hands.
There's a story.
Yeah. Now, also this weekend, have we got time for this in part one? I'm not sure. Arsenal, Blackpool, Chelsea, Wigan, sorry, part three for you. In part two, before any of that, listeners, Spurs trip to Switzerland and Harry's hilarious plastic pitch routine, plus more European news and chat, etc. All of that after this.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
Now, Young Boys 3, Lucky Boys 2 in the classy headline words of the Times, actually, on, what was it, Wednesday morning. Mm. Mm, plenty of reaction to this. Tiki Taki says, did Spurs bring their own lasagna? This is just hilarious. Pato, who says you can't win with kids? You know, because they're young boys. Tiki Taki again with one about Catholic priests. Yeah. Roy A1, Redknapp is a total disgrace. All this ill-informed, out-of-date, brainless whining about the pitch before and after the game is pathetic. Dirk, it's the English media's fault. They keep bigging up these teams like Spurs and telling us what a great player Dawson is, and he gets found out by a small European team. Second goal was his fault, and Young Boys players are pressing all the Tottenham players except Dawson because they know that when he has the ball, he's just going to hit it aimlessly long. You did minute by minute on this game, and they did come back in fine style, and many would say they're not badly placed to go through, still Spurs.
Yeah, I mean, almost ironically, the player that set them on the way to being able to get a result out of it was Sebastian Bassong, who was so bad in his defensive duties up to that point, in the you know, massively at fault for at least a couple of the goals. I don't know how Tottenham prepared for it. Obviously, I wasn't there in the changing room. I don't know what was said and how much research had been done, but it just smacked of a team that had showed up totally expecting to walk away with the game, not understanding that just because this was a team who, you know, perhaps weren't sort of a regular feature on the European scene, were obviously to have reached this point going to be a well-organised side, going to have something about them. And
had beaten Fenerbahce in the previous round.
Yeah, no? And for all that, you know, Harry Redknapp wanted to talk about plastic pitches afterwards, I thought Dawson's comment was the revealing one, where he basically said it wasn't about the plastic pitch, we just didn't wake up.
Did you see anything strange about the pitch?
There was no point in... I mean, obviously the ball is going to bounce slightly differently, but actually these modern pitches, they're not old AstroTurf like the ones that Redknapp was playing on when he was at QPR, like the ones that we would have been playing on when we were at school. These are proper synthetic grass. They are actually... I'm sure everyone here's probably played on one by now. They're actually pretty good to play on. And there was nothing about the way the ball was moving that suggested that Tottenham were particularly caught out by it at any moment. And equally, I'm quite certain that Tottenham's players train on these surfaces all the time. I'm sure Tottenham have some in their own facilities.
Well, it's interesting. Redknapp, before the game, said, "I'm sure we're ready to play and AstroTurf shouldn't be a problem because technically we've got players like Modric." You know, you can see him and all these people playing on AstroTurf. You could see Modric playing on anything, couldn't you? And then, of course, he says after the game, "I have to be truthful. I had this nasty feeling. You know, we didn't like it yesterday, and tonight the players were pulling faces and etc." I think that was poor on Redknapp's behalf. It was an excuse. They didn't show up for the first 30 minutes. But, you know, they're 1-5 favourites to go through because, you know, they only need a win now at White Hart Lane.
I think Redknapp's a superb manager, but he's a horrible piece of work. When did he ever accept? When is he? I can't remember last time he just said, "Yeah, we lost Ferran Square. I got that wrong." He's just a dismal.
He's not
man.
Alone in that, though.
No, he's not. But I think he's one of the worst, personally. Always blaming something.
Wenger's a lovely, lovely guy, but Wenger's a terrible loser as well.
Yeah, so. But there's different ways of doing it. For example, Redknapp can be quite nasty in that if he's decided he doesn't want a player, he'll just slam them in public and stuff like that. It's quite unpalatable, I think. But
it is. Although he has turned a bit. For example, you know, Gomez, he wanted to get rid of, season and a half ago, but he's slowly been persuaded to change. But I do think you're right. Sometimes when he's made his mind up with someone, that's it.
I don't think it speaks massively to his judgment that two of the players who, you know, perhaps were instrumental in the end, well, Gomez, I suppose, did let in. Although I don't think he was really at fault for any of the goals. Gomez and then Pavlyuchenko were two players who he was very quick to write off and who, you know, had he had his way quick enough, might not still be at the club.
And I think also what Rob's saying is absolutely spot on. It's not just the fact that he decides he doesn't like a player, which is the manager's prerogative. It's the fact that he'll be quite public about it and will deride them.
Well, do you remember
in,
of course,
in front of the press?
The famous one is the Sandra Redknapp comment. That's just not on, you know.
It's okay for us to slag Harry off.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
He can't slag players off.
I don't know if we're about to put this game to bed. I mean, I think that Tottenham will go through. I think that at home you would expect them to be able to win by a single goal and not concede two along the way. I think that you'd imagine they'd come out a bit more ready for what they're about to face. And Young Boys are ultimately a more limited side than Tottenham. But I think that there's a couple of things need to be said. First of all, is he going to keep playing 4-4-2 doggedly all the way through the season? Because you see that all of the other managers of English clubs in the last few seasons have realised that in Europe you can't get away with that against a lot of teams. And I think that was possibly part of what happened against Young Boys, playing a flat 4-4-2. And the other thing I just wanted to say is that the one player who really did emerge from that game, with credit for Tottenham, Gareth Bale, I thought he was outstanding in a really poor performance. I thought that some of the balls he put across, it could have easily... That's the thing, Tottenham could easily have scored more. It's just that they could easily have conceded about six.
No, we shall see. That's next week then. Could see some surprises in the group stage of the Champions League, because there were one or two other turn-ups. Happel beating Salzburg 3-2 away, a game that featured Nigerian goalkeeper Vincent Iniyama putting the ball into the other team's net for once. You probably remember his antics during the World Cup. A good keeper, though. He took the penalty for them early on. Slovakian champions Žilina winning 2-0 away in Prague. So they're well set for making the group stages. Braga beat Sevilla as well in a stadium with just two sides. Rather lovely. You've got a kind of rock cliff face and some rubble and stuff. I quite like that.
Sheffield United around
in
the mid-90s.
Werder Bremen beat Sampdoria 3-1 with disastrous consequences for Italy's UEFA coefficient and all that. It was their first game of the season under a new manager. Cassano was rubbish.
I think it's unfortunate in some ways for... I mean, I think the coefficient was going to get lost anyway, but I think if you were... you know, hoping for them to hold on to the coefficient. I think that what's it's almost unfortunate that Samp were the team who got through, because Samp are a team on a very small budget. They are quite a limited team, actually, that got through in great part on the organisational skills of Gigi Del Neri last season. He's now not there anymore, and I think they're out of their depth.
And what does it say, though, about Serie A, apart from Inter won the European Cup last season, that actually when you look at Samp, you look at, you know, look at Juve squad, you look at Roma squad, there's not a lot there anymore, is there?
Which it's is interesting, isn't it? So you're saying the team that finished fourth is struggling against a team in Europe, and what does that mean about the... Oh, wait, that happened in the Premier League as well.
There's a little difference.
Yeah, there is a big difference. Spurs played Young Boys of Bern. This lot played Werder Bremen.
You're not trying to tell me that
Sampdoria are a small team. And as Paolo was pointing out, one of the reasons why they managed to overachieve all the way to fourth place was Gigi Del Neri.
Yeah, and he's gone. Exactly. I think that's it. I think you are looking at a team that, I think if you looked at budgets, it'd be much more reasonable. And even then, I think the budgets just generally in Serie A are a fraction of what they are in the Premier League. And yes, that is an indicative fact. And of course, the quality will be slightly lower for the lack of money that's there. But last season, I think their total annual budget was something like €24 million on player salaries. I mean, there are players in the Premier League earning half of that on their own. And there are players in Serie A earning half of that on their own. But, you know, it's sort of equivalent, Sampdoria being in the Champions League, to, you know, it's a team smaller than Everton, really, nicking that fourth spot. And I think if you had a team like Napoli, like Juventus, you would see a different situation.
You're slightly misinterpreting what I was trying to say. It was a lonesome pan, really, for the good old days where, you'd have Sampdoria with Mancini and Viale up front. You know, and you'd have six or seven great teams. That's all.
Yeah, it's not
a criticism of Italy.
A bit like how in cricket the world kind of misses a strong West Indies. I'm not saying Serie A is not strong, but the world feels it like
it's
in
not
a
that strong, is it?
The football world's in order when Serie A is omnipotent.
I have to say, you know, we were making the case because Del Neri's gone with Sampdoria. Werder Bremen came into this game having just lost at Mesut Özil, so and barely seemed to notice. We'll have Raphael Honigstein's take on the new Bundesliga season, which starts and, of course, involves Werder Bremen. It starts this weekend. He'll be on Monday, although you can see his video preview up, I think, on the site at the moment. Is that right, Sean?
It'll be up later today. And we also have he'll be having an in-depth team-by-team guide on the sport blog tomorrow.
A lot of love for Raphael Honigstein. Meantime, another valued contributor and friend of Football Weekly is Sid Lowe. And having just talked about Mesut Özil, let's hear now from a man who was there at his presentation. Sid.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you.
Excellent. You were there then at the Bernabeu for the Mesut Özil presentation.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting because he managed to basically answer all the questions, give reasonably detailed answers, but not say anything. He did a very, very good job of protecting himself. But he did manage to say one or two things that I thought were really interesting. And more than anything else, he managed to destroy one or two of the kind of almost without intending to. It didn't look like he was deliberately trying to shoot down stories, but he managed to destroy a couple of stories really quite quietly. One was the suggestion that his dad had been negotiating with Florentino Perez. He said, no one from my family has met Florentino Perez. He said, I haven't met him yet. He was then asked about Ramadan, and of course it had all been talked up in the Spanish press that he was on Ramadan, so it was very difficult. He wasn't training. He was fulfilling it to the letter. And he said, well, I'm a professional footballer. It's almost impossible to do Ramadan properly. So if I have a day off, I try and fast. Otherwise, I'm not. And then the other thing that he said, which I think is fundamentally what in the long run is going to be quite significant, is he was asked where he was going to play. And he said, well, I'm a number 10. I play behind the striker. And so then a big question is, well, two questions, one slightly bigger than the other. One big-ish one is what happens to Sergio Canales? And the other one is, when he's finally fit, what happens to Kaká, who was supposedly the standard bearer of this sort of new Real Madrid?
Well, it's interesting because last season, Real Madrid's cast-offs, Arjen Robben and Wesley Sneijder, were the kind of the fortune of other teams, Bayern Munich and Inter, went all the way to the Champions League final. Who do you think are we going to see a similar caliber of player leaving, and if so, where might they go?
Well, what we are going to see is some departures now, because as Jorge Valdano said yesterday, although I really love something that Jorge Valdano said last year during the summer transfer window. He said, this is a time of year when you shouldn't trust anything that anyone tells you, and I include what I say in that. So maybe we should take with a pinch of salt what he said yesterday when he said, this is the end of our signings, but there will be departures. Now, there have to be departures because Spanish rules limit squads to 25 players, which, of course, now English rules do as well. Real Madrid have 26. They also have three foreigners too many. So as Valdano said, no Spaniards will leave. So there now has to be some departures. And the most significant one in terms of the position with the arrival of Ozil is it's almost certain now that Rafa van der Vaart, at the very least, Madrid will look for a departure for him. Whether or not they'll find one is another issue. So he will almost certainly go. They will try and find clubs to take both of the Diarras off their hand, or at least get rid of one of the two, Lassana Diarra or Mohamedou Diarra. And then there's Fernando Gago, who, of course, Man City tried so hard to sign during the winter transfer window back in Christmas, but won't try and do so again now. So I think the player that's most likely to have an impact if he leaves, of course, of those is Rafa van der Vaart, in much the same way as Robin and Schneider did.
We were mentioning Sevilla getting beaten 1-0 away to Braga in the Champions League playoffs. What does that mean for the Spanish league, the fourth place side not getting a success in Champions League preliminaries, do you think?
I'm tempted to say it doesn't mean anything yet because, of course, there's still a second leg right. in Seville. And I suspect that Sevilla will get through. But if they weren't to get through, then it would be a real kick in the teeth for them. Not least because Sevilla have done okay in the Champions League when they've been in the last couple of times. So it's not just a case of losing a team from the Champions League. It's a case of losing a team who everybody thinks could do a pretty good job and make the Spanish League look pretty good if they were to get into Champions League. Unlike, for example, the side that they nicked the Champions League place off in the 93rd minute of last season, which was Mallorca. I think if Mallorca had got into the Champions League, most people in Spain would have thought, well, they're not going to last. Whereas with Sevilla, they think they will. So it would be a really big blow if they were not to make it. I think they'll still make it, though, because they've got the home leg to come.
If Mallorca had made it into the Champions League, would they not have been allowed to take part, though?
Well, as it turns out, that's the case because, of course, Platini has said that they can't take part in the Europa League, which is what they got into the Champions League because of their financial situation, because they don't fill the requisites of UEFA. Mallorca's fans are going crazy about this. Mallorca, the club, are going crazy about this as well. Mallorca is saying they're going to take UEFA to court for lost earnings because of this. Now, I think it's important to make one thing very clear here. Almost the default setting of football clubs in Spain, in fact of lots of institutions in Spain, say we're going to take you to court, and it doesn't necessarily mean they'll actually do it, and even if they were to do it, it wouldn't necessarily mean they have a case, but it's an illustration of the fact that they're irritated with UEFA. It's a way as well, of course, of rallying everyone to their side and making sure Mallorca's fans think that the bad guys are UEFA rather than the club. And I think this is one of the things that Platini has done very well, is to talk about financial problems at clubs, not just in terms of the financial problems, but in terms of cheating, to talk about it as financial doping, because you know, the reality is Mallorca's fans are saying, well, you're taking off a European place that we won, and that's not fair. But, well, the counter-argument is you won a European place because you had players that you hadn't paid for because you broke the rules. That's not fair either. And one really clear way of looking at that situation is to say, last year Mallorca beat Athletic Bilbao, Aduriz scored the winning goal for Mallorca, Aduriz had been signed by Athletic Bilbao, scored the goal against them, and Mallorca had never paid for him, so that's not exactly fair either.
It's just wrong, isn't it, Sid? Listen, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for that update. When does the Spanish season start?
The Spanish season starts next weekend. So we've got the second leg of the Spanish Supercopa this weekend. There's great news, by the way, in one of the Catalan dailies. I absolutely love this. Sandra Rosé, the new Barcelona president, has fulfilled his first promise. There are new women's toilets at the Camp Nou.
Hey, fantastic. Excellent.
Speaking of women's toilets,
yes.
At the World Cup.
No, but I haven't seen you this animated since well, the start.
It's Sean's natural habitat, you know, a women's toilet.
I'd heard that Barcelona hadn't got a pot to bid, but obviously...
No, about the World Cup, this is really quite a dull story, but the press box, there were only two toilets, one for men, one for women, and this is for about 2,000 or 3,000 people in the press, in the media centre, and there was probably about 99% men and 1% women.
The first day I
did
saw
you... Did you go in the women's bathroom?
No, but there was one or two journalists that
did. I
would
have gone.
Would you?
Why would you not? It's just a drawing on a door. It's exactly the same kind of porcelain you're going to find on the other side. Okay, that's...
I'm enjoying this conversation enormously. Right. I was just thinking, you say it's only a drawing on the door.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. If you go on a train, for example, it's the same toilet for women and men. Mm-hmm.
The point is, and women listeners will surely say, it's all very well for men to say, I can use a women's toilet, but women aren't exactly going to say, I can use a man's toilet because it's...
Well, no, I don't think
well,
that's an issue.
Well, they can use it if it's a sit-down toilet.
Well, yeah, they can use it,
or...
but if men have been at it, Sid, I think we all know that...
But the other point...
Well, that's why we're not allowed in women's toilets, because they know we'll ruin it.
No, yeah. That's fair.
But seriously, though, if you go in there and suddenly, you know, you unveil things, and there's a woman already in the women's toilet, the one woman at in the press box.
You unveil things? Sean, you've got very strange clothes.
Let's just stop there, eh? Because otherwise it's going to get... Sid, listen, okay, brilliant. Thank you very much for that. We look forward to...
I'm enjoying this. toilets, please.
We'll catch up with you next week. I hope to get your preview on the new Spanish season.
Yeah, fantastic. Speak to you then.
Sid Lowe in Spain. In a second or two, we'll be looking through your posts and hearing, I think, from Amy Lawrence on the many hot topics in the French football, and also casting her eye over one or two of the other big weekend fixtures in the Premier League. Okay, posts. Doug the Head. Can anyone explain this bizarre Kevin Prince Boateng business? Why has he moved to Genoa to go immediately on loan to Milan to seemingly sign for them permanently at the end of the season? Seems weird to me, Paolo.
Yeah, I mean, it is a transfer that has raised eyebrows in Italy as well. And, complicated transfers are almost the norm in Italy. But I think essentially it seems to be an issue of financial liquidity in that basically Milan don't have the money up front, whereas Genoa do. So Genoa, in this way that, again, Italian clubs sometimes operate, you know, they're building up a good relationship with Milan, hoping for some favours in return at some point down the line. And they're saying, we'll buy him for you and we'll just loan him to you and then you can give us the money later when you have it. And what's curious about it is that this isn't an entirely unfamiliar structure of things to happen in Italy, but normally it's the other way around. Normally it's the club that would be traditionally viewed as a bigger club loaning the player out to a smaller club. Now, in a way, it feels a bit like Genoa are almost big-timing Milan. It's like, you know, actually, Genoa have signed a lot of big players this summer. They've signed Luca Toni, they've signed Eduardo, they've signed Rafinha from Schalke, they've signed Miguel Veloso, they've signed a lot of players. And now they're sort of going, oh, it's okay, you know, don't worry about it, little Milan, we'll help you out and, you know, we'll expect a favour off you later on. But it is a curious one.
In other posting news, Kicking the Nads, responding to our talk of the worst debut ever, says at least Joe Cole's problems in his first game for Liverpool didn't start until his debut, whereas after Patrice Loco signed for PSG in 1995, he went on the rise, exposed himself to a policewoman and ended up in a mental asylum all before he kicked a ball. A very fair point.
Did you mention the Cascarino Wimpy debut?
No, tell us about that.
Well, he got on the train, thought he wouldn't be playing, so he went and had a massive wimpy at about 1:30 when he got to Gillingham. Turns out when he got to the match, someone had dropped injured, so he was on the bench. Then someone else gets injured in the first 10 minutes, and he had to go on. And he said, all I could think of for the next 30 minutes was about the wimpy, whatever it is, swilling around my gut. So, yeah, that was an interesting debut.
Yeah. Well, all sorts of things happening in French football at the moment, and you'll all have seen that extraordinary 18-game ban that the French Federation have handed Nicolas Anelka, with similar but if smaller suspensions for one or two of the other World Cup rebels. Amy Lawrence now joins us on the phone. Amy, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, James.
Lovely to hear your voice. What's been the reaction in France to the Anelka ban?
Everybody's very frustrated at how much this has dragged on, because obviously it was a horrible summer for all concerned with French football. And there was a sense, at least, that with a new coach, Dominic was gone, the era was over, the players had all been given what they thought was a probably reasonable punishment, which was the entire lot of them getting banned for the Norway friendly last month, that people thought that would sort of be near enough the time to have a fresh start. So to have this kind of new set of draconian punishments and to drag over all the misery all over again and to basically put some handcuffs round Laurent Blanc, who's starting his career as the new French coach in really difficult circumstances, is frustrating everybody, because whatever they might feel of the players, and most people in France have less than no respect for most of the guys who went to the World Cup now anyway, particularly the ringleaders, I think people were keen to try and move on. And there's sort of a bit of a depression now in French football that it's not just the national team that's feeling it. I mean, if you look at what's happened at the beginning of the domestic season, it's been a real washout, and the teams that you'd expect to be challenging, the champions Marseille, Bordeaux, who have done so well recently, and Lyon, who of course have been champions for years up until the last couple of seasons, have all had horrible starts and have a point between them. So it's not a great time in French football.
Two of the three relegation slots in Ligue 1 are filled by
it's a bit like, if
French...
you can imagine, Chelsea and Man United started the season, both of them with no points after two games. I mean, it's almost impossible. But Marseille also struggling with losing a couple of players. But
and you got Hatem Ben Arfa threatening to go on strike there as well.
Yep, and you know, Didier Deschamps has been quite withering about him, and has pinned the blame on him quite firmly, and said that he tried very hard to talk to Ben Arfa a lot during the last year, and to get his head straight to help him to fulfil some of the potential he showed as a very young player. But he's kind of given up on him, and they just don't talk anymore. So it's quite difficult to envisage a situation where the coach and one of the main players have a sort of zero tolerance of what attitude towards one another. So I don't think that, I think he'll be on his way somewhere soon. And it looks like Marseille are trying to buy Loic Remy, who has been on the radar of quite a lot of English clubs. It's difficult to pin down exactly why it's been such a flat start. It may well be linked to the World Cup sort of lack of morale generally that has kind of swept over the footballing fraternity.
Abject stuff, Amy. Listen, thank you very much for that, and we'll see what happens when the season gets a few more games up on the board. Nice one, thanks, Amy.
Take care then.
And you too. Of course, Nicolas Anelka finds the whole thing hilarious. The whole thing is a nonsense to turn the page because new coach Laurent Blanc needs to be able to work in peace. These people are clowns. I'm dying with laughter, which is pretty much Nicolas's default mode, of course. But I quite enjoyed his ongoing kind of refusal to kowtow to the...
I thought it was pretty pathetic.
Really? I mean, he's been banned for 80. He's never coming back.
I just think it sort of sums up his attitude and a lot of his teammates.
You should never besmirch your nation's dignity by not training or whatever, but given the French Federation's total inability to move beyond Dominic, despite the continued evidence of his unsuitability for the role, was what the French players did not justified, in that if they hadn't done it, Dominic might well still be in charge.
I don't think he would have done. I mean, I think one of the reasons why I didn't get him rid of him before was that he was still under contract. It would have cost a little bit of money to get him go. I agree with you. He should have been turfed out after Euro 2008, which was another shambolic campaign. But I don't think there's any excuse for Nelka doing what he did.
All right, then. Okay. Now, let's finish off with one or two other games from the weekend. I mentioned back at the start, Arsenal and Blackpool. Big news at Arsenal, of course, the fact that Sami Nasri has just had minor knee surgery. This was a bit of a bolt from the blue, was it, Paolo?
Yeah, apparently he suffered a meniscal injury during the Liverpool game. It's frustrating because, I don't know, I think you could overstate how impressive he was, because Arsenal weren't as penetrative as you would have liked them to be, and he was providing a lot of their forward play in the early stages. But he had a decent first game of the season, and it's frustrating for Arsenal.
It is, because Fabregas as well hasn't been fully fit, and Arshavin is continuing to be a mysterious enigma-type fellow.
And a
heavier one than he was 12 months ago. Right.
That's a bit of a worry. Then still, they are hosting Blackpool, no kind of Hull from 2 years ago problems ahead of them.
You hope not, but I don't know. I mean, I think there's obviously a massive problem in defence net coming up next week. If Giroud is still out and you've got Koscielny banned, I don't really know who plays at centre back anymore. I mean,
Song.
I guess if Song's fit, then yeah.
Squillaci.
Well, that was the name linked this morning, but I don't know how real that is.
Chelsea, meantime, are playing Wigan. This is exactly what Wigan need, don't they? You know, they've just been beaten 4-0 by Blackpool. The previous game was 8-0. At Chelsea,
but also got beaten at Wigan last season.
That's true, they did, didn't they?
So it seems very unlikely that they'll do it again this year, but you know, you never know.
Right, okay.
I mean, I'm quite interested in the Stoke Spurs game, because Stoke have, if you look at their league table the last 2 years, they have a really good home record. But I was just looking earlier, and actually they only beat one team that finished above them last season, Blackburn. You know, they lost to the big four, or the top four last season. They drew against the positions 5-8, but it'd be very interesting to see Spurs' resolve and their grit after the defeat midweek.
And I assume King won't play because they want to keep him for the the young boys return. So yeah, that'll be a hard game. Stoke away is probably a game you look forward to the least of any outside the top four. It's just right. Horrible.
Stoke now with added Kenwyn Jones, of course. Blackburn. They are at Birmingham. As I say, Birmingham just picked up Matt Derbyshire on loan. And Blackburn, who knows who they could be picking up soon, Sean?
Well, this is the potential new owner, Hassan Ali Saeed, who... Yeah.
Are you suggesting that this 36-year-old previously unknown lawyer from Bahrain, who says that his total wealth, he estimates, is about £8 billion, and he wants to buy the club for £300 million, and the first player he wants to sign is David Beckham? Are you suggesting there's something that doesn't convince you about this chap?
Possibly. I like the fact that I was 26 when I started following the Premier League.
And quite early, isn't it?
Well, possibly. I don't know. I mean, nothing in football surprises you anymore.
Right.
But if I had £300 million in my bank, I would not be talking to you. Well, I would be. We'd go for lunch at some swanky West End restaurant. But I would not spend it on Blackburn, as endearing though they are.
He did explain it very well. He says he didn't want to buy one of these clubs that are loaded down with debt because none of his however many companies he owns has any debt. So he thought that this is a club with lots of potential, which is pretty much the word we all associate with Blackburn Rovers. What do you think? Is this deal for real? Yes or no, Rob?
It could be. One thing to have in place is a top-class manager. I think a really underrated manager. I don't know. I think last time everyone begrudged Blackburn Jack Walker's cash. This time they're now actually been pretty much a model club. They run really well. Mm. You're right, it's not the first club you think of, but I think good luck to them if it comes up.
But I mean, I think the key point is they finished 10th last season. They did very well under Allardyce, but he's pledging initial 80 to 100 million for new players, which is a lot of money, but it probably only takes Blackburn to 6th. Mm. You know, so it's, you know, is someone that's that successful and a businessman, is that going to be enough for him?
I think this season with Manchester City may well end up being a demonstration of how much money is required to actually get into those places, because they've spent that money and they haven't started overwhelmingly yet.
But I would imagine...
That's a very interesting point. Now, just to say that I don't think that Manchester City spending, what, 126 million and not making the Champions League means you need to spend more than that. I think it just means you need to spend it
more,
better.
And yeah. Also, Allardyce... I would say pound for pound in terms of what he spent, it's probably done as well as any manager over the last 10 years. I know his style of football can be
Bolton
sometimes...
days.
But even here, even Davis. At Blackburn, he's not getting credit he deserves. Yeah. They beat Everton last week and no one says anything. He's done an outstanding job.
An astonishing howler by
But even
Tim
so,
Howard.
You know, look at them.
It was a well-taken goal, though.
I bet you they beat Arsenal at home next week, the week after next. He just, everything he does, because of one bad, or reasonably bad 6 months at Newcastle, he's just been written off. I think he's really underrated.
Well, there you go. That's pretty much it for Foot Weekly Extra. Of course, there are various other games this weekend. West Brom, Sunderland, West Ham, Bolton, some big matches there. And Everton Wolves, of course. We'll be looking back on all the Premier League action on Monday in Football Weekly, when we'll also be looking forward to the return legs of the Champions League and Europa, etc., etc. So in the meantime, it's many, many thanks to today's guest producer, Andy Duckworth, and to Sean Ingle and to Paolo Bandini. Gian Paolo Bandini, as Sean Ingle was revealing today. Is that correct?
That is my full first name,
ooh,
yeah.
All right, then. And Rob Smythe?
It is just Rob.
Roberto Smythe.
Thanks very much, listeners, for joining us. We'll be back after the weekend. Have a great one. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.